Good evening. It's good to see everyone here this evening. We have about as good a crowd tonight, I believe, as we had this morning. Actually, our Sunday night crowds have increased. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, but I am very appreciative of that, and I know that the folks who are sitting around you are appreciative of that. But even more than that, and most importantly, I know that the Lord appreciates your presence here and the interest in spiritual things that has brought you our way. Good to see everybody tonight. The sermon that we're going to present tonight is really a companion to the things that we were talking about this morning. We talked from the book of Joshua this morning, and that was the lion's share of our daily Bible reading for the month of July. But as we noted, that really the daily Bible reading began in the book of Deuteronomy. We're going to take our lesson tonight from an event that happened at the end of Deuteronomy that is perhaps rather familiar to us. I want you to turn, if you would, to Deuteronomy chapter 32. Deuteronomy chapter 32. Moses has led an obstinate people through the wilderness for 40 years. And in that 40 years, an entire generation of people who came out of Egypt have died in the wilderness. And a whole new generation has arisen. Included in those who have died by Deuteronomy chapter 32 are Miriam, Moses' sister, and Aaron, the high priest, Moses' brother. Now it is time for Moses to pass from this earth. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 32, we pick up the reading at verse 48. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 48 says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses that very same day, saying, 'Go up to this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, across from Jericho. View the land of Canaan, which I give to the children of Israel as a possession. And die on the mountain which you ascend, and be gathered to your people, just as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor, was gathered to his people. Because you trespassed against me among the children of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not hallow me in the midst of the children of Israel. Yet you shall see the land before you, though you shall not go there into the land which I am giving to the children of Israel.'" And so in chapter 33 then, Moses blesses the tribes, and then the thing that God told him to do, to go up to the mountain by himself, and there he would die, comes to fruition in chapter 34. And I want to begin reading at verse 1. Deuteronomy 34 and verse 1 says, "Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the south and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And the Lord said to him, 'This is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there.' So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he, that is God, buried him in the valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows his grave to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, and his natural vigor diminished. The children of Israel wept for Moses in the plain of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended." So ends then the life of perhaps the greatest character in all of the Old Testament. The great lawgiver, the man who was compared to the Messiah himself. When you think about the death of Moses, what is it about it that impresses you? Is it the tranquility of the situation? I mean, can you imagine going up onto a mountain and being there by yourself, just you and God, and communing with God? What a tranquil scene that must have been as he passed from life then. Certainly in comparison to the very tumultuous life, when you go back and you think about the life that Moses had lived, it was anything but a calm life. Yet now here he comes to the end of his life, and the scene is one of tranquility. You might think, well, to me it is the uniqueness of the death that is really impressive. And it is true. Moses had a very unique kind of death. How many people do you know who've been told to go up to a mountain by God and there talk to God and then die so peacefully? I'll tell you what strikes me about Moses' death. What strikes me about Moses' death, and I think what struck Moses about Moses' death, was that it made his life seemingly incomplete. You see, the one thing that Moses had so longed for in his life, the thing that at least for 40 years of his life he had been so looking forward to, the opportunity to enter into the promised land with the people of Israel, he was not able to do. In Deuteronomy chapter 3, we find how that worked on the mind of Moses. In Deuteronomy chapter 3 and verse 23, we have record of this conversation between God and Moses. In verse 23, Moses is saying, "Then I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, You have begun to show Your servant Your greatness and Your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven and on earth who can do anything like Your works and Your mighty deeds?" Now, if your child came to you with that kind of a statement, would you figure something was up? "Father, You are the absolute greatest Father who has ever lived on the face of the earth. You are the wisest, You are the most understanding, You are the most patient, You are the most generous Father who has ever lived." I know what my father would have thought about that if I would have come to him with that kind of a statement. He would have started checking his back pocket, his wallet. Moses has a request that he's going to give to his father. He says in verse 25, "I pray, let me cross over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, those pleasant mountains in Lebanon. Lord, I want to go over. I want to cross over Jordan with the rest of the people, and I want to set foot on that promised land. I want to be able to walk the hills and the valleys of that promised land with the people of God." This is what Moses longed to do, what he'd been longing to do in all of that 40 years of wilderness wandering. Verse 26, "But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. So the Lord said to me, 'Enough of that. Speak no more to me of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift your eyes toward the west and the north and the south and the east. Behold it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan.'" God said, "My decision is made. And you are not going to cross in to the land of Canaan. You're not going to walk those valleys. You're not going to walk those hills. You're not going to be with the people who you've led for 40 years as they come into the land of Canaan." God said, I'll let you look at it, but you can never go in. Why did God command His great servant to go up to a mountain and die without being able to enjoy the one thing that would have made his life complete? The answer to that is sin. In Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 51, God tells Moses why he cannot go in. It was his sin at Kadesh Barnea. And the sin that he is talking about is referred or is presented to us in Numbers chapter 20. The children of Israel in Numbers chapter 20, they've pretty much completed the wilderness wandering. But a difficulty comes up, and they, as they usually do when difficulties came up, they began to complain about the difficulty. And rather than going to God and praying to God about the difficulty, they began to question God's goodness. They began to question God's love for them. They began to question the wisdom of God. Why did you bring us out here? Complaint after complaint after complaint. On two occasions, they complained because there was a lack of water for them in the wilderness. The first time, the first generation who came out of the land of Egypt have a situation where they don't have enough water. In Exodus chapter 17, we see their complaint about the fact that water is not available to them. It says in verse 3, the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? There's your complaint. And Moses' response to that, as it often is to their complaining, is he took it to God. Verse 4, so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And so it seems that almost in a panic, Moses turns to the Lord, which he should have done. What everyone should have done. Moses turns to the Lord and pleads for help. And the answer comes in verses 5 and 6. The Lord said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you here on the rock of Horeb, and you shall strike the rock and water will come out and that the people may drink. Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And so catastrophe in their minds is averted by simply pleading with God, letting God know what the problem is. And the problem is no more because God takes care of it. And then in Numbers chapter 20, we see the same kind of situation. It's not the same situation, but it is a similar situation. This one happens some 40 years later, and it is the second generation that has come out of Egypt. The young generation, the old generation now has passed away. And now the second generation has the same kind of problem, no water. And so what do? They didn't learn much from their parents. They begin to complain. Verse 3, the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Oh, if only God had killed us when He killed our parents, is the statement that they make. Why have you brought up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? Is it not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink? Now, on both of these occasions, they're complaining to Moses, and they're asking Moses, why have you done this to us? Knowing full well that Moses is the representative of God. And so when they're complaining to Moses and accusing Moses, they are accusing God. And that thing that they say at the end of verse 5, how hideous is that? God made promises to us. God's not keeping His promises. God said something. God lied to us. God deceived us. He told us that we were going to a land that flowed with milk and honey. In verse 6, again, Moses and Aaron appealed to the Lord. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Then the Lord, and this is the solution, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals." Sounds just exactly like what happened in Exodus 17 to their parents, doesn't it? And the solution seems at least pretty close to the same solution. But now, beginning in verse 9, we have a difference. So Moses took the rod before him, before the Lord, as He commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And He said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Got the water. But Moses has sinned. And God tells him that he has sinned. In verse 12, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I give them." Condemnation. Not eternal condemnation, but He says, "You sinned against me. You didn't hallow me. You didn't separate me from you. Therefore, you're not going into the land." What was his sin? That he hit the rock? I don't know. The passage doesn't tell us that God told him to hit the rock. And perhaps it is that in hitting the rock there was disobedience involved. But notice there in verse 12, that's not what God says is the reason that Moses is not going to the land. It is the fact that he has not made God holy before the people, made a separation between himself and God before the people. In Psalm chapter 106, verses 32 and 33, Moses is referred to again, and it says that Moses sinned with his lips in this situation. It is what Moses said that causes God to say, "You're not going into the land." Perhaps it is there in verse 10 that when he says, "Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Perhaps that's the sin. The question would be, we who? You and Aaron and God? It is God who brings the water. It is God who has a right to be indignant against these people. Moses exalted himself and Aaron to the stature of God in a public display before the entire congregation of Israel. And God says, "I will not let you get away with that display of unbelief." And so God said to Moses and to Aaron, will not go into the land of Canaan. So we ask the question, what is it that caused Moses to sin? And the answer to that is anger. Moses got mad. He heated up, didn't he? You know, heat's a powerful force. You ever seen heat at work? Heat's a wonderful thing. You can do tremendous things with just a little bit of heat, the pressure that heat can bring on something. Power plants are powered by heat. The reason we have electricity in this building tonight, air conditioning and lights and all of that, is ultimately because of heat. Heat is tremendous when it is controlled. But it can be a horrific thing when it is not controlled. I pipe fitted for 10 years before I became a preacher. And I was able to see firsthand the power of heat. I've seen heat rip through a 1-inch piece of pipe when it got out of control. We've probably all seen buildings that were blown sky high by heat. You see, heat's a tremendous thing when it's under control, but heat is a horrible thing when it is out of control. And here we have Moses getting hot, and his heat was out of control. And as a result, he lost his greatest desire. What a message that is for us. Remember what the Apostle Paul encouraged the Ephesians in Ephesians chapter 4? He's kind of going down through a litany of things that they need to be mindful of, that they need to watch themselves over in order to remain faithful to God. In verses 26 and 27 of Ephesians 4, he speaks of anger. And I want you to notice there that what he says is not, don't ever get angry. Because you see, there is a proper time to be angry. There's such a thing as righteous indignation. I worry about the person who never gets angry. Now, some people get angrier quicker than others. I'll just tell you, I don't get angry very easy. But there are times when it is necessary for me to be angry. And so Paul doesn't tell the Ephesians, don't ever get angry. What he says there in verse 26, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. What he says is, it's okay to be angry sometimes. It's okay to have a righteous indignation, to be angry about things that we ought to be angry about. God got angry. Jesus Christ became angry. God said, you can be angry too. But what? But don't lose control. Don't let your anger get out of control so that you do something that you ought not to do, that you in some way violate the law of God. And so I would ask you, what do you do when you get angry? Men, what do you do when you get angry at your wife? Wives, what do you do when you get angry at your husbands? You know, sometimes there's some righteous anger that goes on between a husband and a wife. Amy gets mad at me all the time, believe it or not. Always remind her, don't lose control. But it's right to be angry sometimes, even at your spouse. Parents, what do you do when you get angry with your children? Children, what do you do when you get angry with your parents? What do you do when you get angry with your employer or your employee or your fellow workers or your schoolmates? What do you do when you get angry at your brethren? The message of Moses is, be angry, but do not sin. Don't let your anger cause you to do something that gives the devil an opportunity to use your anger to in some way cause you to violate the holiness of God. That's the message of Moses. Well, as a consequence of Numbers chapter 20, God led Aaron to die on the top of Mount Hor in the presence of Moses and Eleazar. Numbers chapter 20, verses 24 through 29, a very touching scene as Aaron there transfers his things, his robes and things to Eleazar. And then he led Moses to die alone in Mount Nebo, the top of Pisgah at its peak. Deuteronomy chapter 34 and verse 7 says that when Moses died, he was 120 years old. Despite the fact that he was an old man, it says his eyes were not dim. His vigor was not abated. He had the same strength that he had had in his youth. His strength had not faltered like is typical for elderly men. His eyes had not dimmed like is typical for men. Still a healthy fellow. Advancement in age had not ravaged his body. Have you ever thought about how you would like to die? You know, I've heard of some deaths that are horrible deaths. And you think, man, I would not like to die in that manner. But you hear of other deaths that are actually not horrible at all. A number of years ago, several decades ago, there was an elder who stood up before his congregation, led the congregation in prayer, walked back to his seat, and dropped dead of a heart attack. And I'm sure that was a horrible thing for that audience, and I'm sure that the worship assembly just stopped right there because of the horror of that situation. My sister's husband was the preacher there at that time. In fact, it was his first Sunday as the preacher there. My sister called my dad and told him about it. You know what my dad said? I'm jealous. How would you like to die? I'd like to die like Moses. I'd like to be 120 years old and my vigor the same. And eyes not, well, actually, it's too late. Actually, it wouldn't be bad at all for the Lord to say to me, Jerry, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go down to the church building, and I want you to sit down alone at the podium there, and I want you to just think about life for a little while, and then I'm going to take your life. Might be horrible for the next person who came into the building, but I'll tell you, that would be my dream way of dying. What would be your dream way of dying? What would you do if you got a warning like Moses? I suspect Moses set his house in order, don't you? Don't you think that Moses probably went and said goodbye to his family? Well, I know he said goodbye to the tribes. I suspect he prayed to God and asked for forgiveness for any sins that might stand between him and God, including that sin of anger. But here's the point. God hasn't promised me a death like Moses. He hasn't promised me 120 years. And He hasn't promised me a warning to get my house in order. All God has promised to me and all God has promised to you is that one day we're going to die. That is the common lot of all men. Hebrews 9 and verse 27, it is appointed to all men once to die, and after this comes the judgment. And the warning He has given me is that I had better keep my house in order. Go back to 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, and listen to what Peter says there beginning at verse 7. He says, "The end of all things is at hand. Therefore be serious and watchful in your prayers. And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without grumbling. As each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God." What's Peter saying? He's saying, you stay ready. What would you do if you knew that life was going to end for you at a particular moment? Do you think you might start praying? Peter says, you pray. You think you might feel a keen sense of love for God's people, keener than you've ever felt before? Peter says, keep loving. You think you might want to be around the people of God one last time? Peter says, keep being around the people of God. You think you might want to work as hard as you can in the kingdom, ministering, serving the people of God for as long as you have left? Peter says, you keep doing that. You do it as much tomorrow as you did today, and the day after that, and you do it more next week than you did it this week, and more next month than you've done it this month, and more the month after, and the month after, and the year after, and the year after, and the year after. You keep doing what you need to do. You keep keeping on. You stay prepared. Because God hadn't promised us that He's going to come to us and say, okay, time is up. Get your house in order. Get everything ready and come with me. Because we're going to go up to a mountain, and there we're going to sit and talk for a while, and then you're going to die. God hadn't promised us that. He promised it to Moses. He did it with Moses, but He hadn't promised it to us. And so Moses went to the top of Pisgah, and he looked at Canaan, and he died. God buried him there. I ask you, is that the end of Moses? Is that all we find out about Moses? That's, you know, Moses is gone now, never to return. Totally, life totally incomplete in his eyes at least. What about Matthew 17? Transfiguration scene. We see Moses once again. Moses is there in the presence of the Messiah, and he is with Elijah. And Luke tells us in his record of the Transfiguration that Moses has opportunity to sit with Elijah and with the Messiah and talk about Jesus' coming death on the cross. Can you imagine being part of that conversation? Of sitting with Jesus Christ and talking to Him about the death that He is going to give for the sins of the world? Moses had that opportunity. Here's the point of that. We look at Moses' death there in Deuteronomy chapter 34, and we think, man, how incomplete. Can't believe God didn't let him go in. You know, just cross the Jordan and maybe stick a toe in the promised land. Just maybe for a few days. Maybe just for the first battle. Moses can be there with the people of God. Maybe he can go through the conquest with them and see the great victories over all of those kingdoms there in Canaan. What a shame it is that he didn't get to do that. That's what Moses wanted to do. God had something better for him, is the point. Now, God could have let him go in. God could have said, okay, I'm going to let you go. You've put up with these people for 40 years. But I'm going to let you cross the Jordan River with them. I'm going to let you listen to them complain for a few more years. I'm going to let you go through the same blood, sweat, and tears that they go through for 7 years as they conquer these nations. I'm going to let you do that because you want to. Oh, God had something better for him. Which would you rather do? Stay with obstinate people for a while through blood, sweat, and tears, or sit with Jesus Christ and Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration and talk about the wonderful sacrifice that the Messiah was going to make? Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. That's what Paul said in Ephesians 3 and verse 20 about God. That's what He did for Moses. Moses didn't have an inkling of what to ask for as he came to the end of his life. He didn't have a clue about what the most wonderful thing that God could ever do for him could be. He thought it was to go into Canaan with the tribes. Was it really? No. God wanted to do something with him that was exceedingly, abundantly beyond all that Moses could ever think of. All that Moses could ever ask for. And Paul tells the Ephesians and he tells us, it's what God can do for you too. You be faithful to Him. And no matter how you die, He's going to do things for you that are exceedingly abundantly above all that you can ask or think. And that's our sermon for tonight. If you're here this tonight and you're not a Christian, I would implore you to do what you need to do so that you can come to the end of your life as Moses came to the end of his life and have the promise of eternal life. Have the promise of the fulfillment of God doing exceedingly abundantly beyond or above all that you can ever ask and all that you can ever think. Believe in Jesus Christ. Repent of your sins. Confess His name. Let us baptize you into Jesus Christ tonight and see if Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 doesn't come true in your life. Can we help you to obey the gospel? If we can, let us know how we can by coming forward right now. All together we stand.